I was probably 7 or 8, sitting at the dinner table with my family, my mom, my dad, my sister. My mom had prepared an elaborate beef stew for us to eat. We could just smell it. And I don't think it was the first time or the last time, but I definitely proclaimed on that evening that I was not going to eat it. Now, I'm imagining you've been there at one point in your life too, right? Maybe on one side of the plate or other. That moment in which you realize or someone else close to you realizes that they don't want to eat what's put in front of you. And we all have different rules growing up about whether or not you had to eat what was put in front of you, right? Whether or not what was prepared as a family was an expectation for your consumption. And it definitely was an expectation in my family. They tried to be nice about it, of course. You would, you know, get the first question of, well, why don't you just take a little bite first, right? That opening the door to that full meal. But on this day, I was completely convinced I did not want to eat this stew, and I told everyone that. But I was up against a brick wall. And so I relented. Begrudgingly, I put my spoon into my bowl. I brought up the hot liquid towards my mouth. And I don't know if it was as it was going into my mouth or just before, but it was at that moment that I began projectile vomiting over the entire table. For the reason I didn't want to eat that stew, I think, and maybe I didn't even know or had the words, was there was something in my body that didn't feel right, and this stew didn't seem like the right thing to add to the situation. And even though it looked like just a childhood denial that I was being, you know, belligerent or something, I knew something, and I was being told something else about food. My mom says it's the last time that she ever forced me to eat something in my life. So, pro tip. But what it tells me about food is that food is about much more than just the physical nourishment that's on the plate. Food comes with all of the stories and the rules and the expectations and the emotions and the relationships that surround the table, even if no one is there. Because eating is a deeply intimate act. I don't think about it like that because it happens so often, but it is a deeply intimate act. And it's a deeply intimate act because, well, we need it to survive. It's deeply intimate because when we don't have enough of it, it impacts every part of our lives. And when we eat certain foods that don't agree with us, it impacts us in other ways, right? If you've ever had food poisoning, you know. But it's also a deeply intimate act because we're taking something that is not of us, that is from outside of us, and we're bringing it to become a part of us, right? We're taking something that is outside of us, that has been prepared and produced in other places by people we know and people we don't, and we're bringing it in to be made part of our bodies, and we're doing it in a very sensory engaged way, right? I mean, it's not like we're just going to the hospital and getting an IV most of the time to get our nourishment. No, we're putting it in the place in which we smell and taste, where we can sense temperature and texture. Right? The very act of eating is a very intimate experience because we're sensing the whole time. And the nourishment that we receive by eating isn't just the nourishment that's on the table, because we're nourished, or at least we consume, all of those messages that surround the food that we're eating too. I think it's actually impossible for us to separate the foods that we're eating from the messages that surround the foods that are there. I mean, how many of you grew up in a family in which it was the expectation that you cleaned your plate at dinner? Hands up. Even if you weren't hungry, right? How many of you grew up in families in which there was this kind of guilt trip about eating? It went something like this. You should be grateful and not waste your food because there are starving children in Africa, Asia, China, right? Yeah. That one always super confused me. I was like, how is this food going to get there? Why should I have to eat it? And of course, it comes from a place of wanting to inspire generosity and gratitude for this food that nourishes us, but it has this insidious guilt attached to it, right? How many of you grew up in families in which a family member had a disordered relationship with food? They didn't eat enough, they ate too much of it, they ate in ways that weren't healthy, right? How many of you, and you don't have to raise your hands, know how the messages they had about food impacted you? How the stories they told themselves about the types of foods they were supposed to eat, the diets that they were on, the ways that they were eating, it seeps into us because when we eat the food, we eat the stories too. And so eating is this deeply intimate act that comes with all of this emotion, all of these relationships, all of these stories. Am I going to be loved if I continue to eat? Am I not going to be loved if I say no? Who gets to say what my body needs? Is it another person that I trust and love, or is it myself? Do I feel like I'm connected to my body, that eating is a pleasurable, relational act in which family is coming together, or does it kind of feel like I'm servicing a robot? Right? Let's just eat the foods that don't really taste good, but are definitely enough to make it all work. All of these stories that we have become a part of us. And it's impossible for us to separate these ideologies. The stories become a part of us bite by bite, just like the calories that we consume. They become a part of our individual stories. And so that's why when they say we are what we eat, I think we also are what we eat in terms of the stories that surround it. We become those stories too. And for some of us who had healthy upbringings, in which families, in which food and there was a relationship with it, it was about joy and connection, then we have a healthy relationship. But for many of us in our families, we didn't. And I also think in this society itself, this modern Western society, we have a very disordered relationship with food in general. And what's important to realize is that it's not just about my relationship with food and your relationship with food. These relationships cascade upon each other. They reinforce each other, and they become these big societal trends and stories that are entirely difficult to deconstruct from our psyches. Because when the story is amplified by tens of thousands, millions of people believing the same thing, acting in the same way, changing the types of foods that are in the grocery store that are being shown on the Food Network, all of these changes reinforce certain narratives about food. And if those narratives disconnect us from the very act of eating and nourishing our bodies, and disconnect us from ourselves, and disconnect us maybe from even feeling grateful for the bodies that are ours, then we have a disordered space around food. So I'll give you one interesting historical example. It's kind of one of these mass anxieties, these mass stories about food that you might not have thought about. So for the past 6 months, I've been doing a new experiment in the kitchen. I love cooking, I really do. And so for the past 6 months, I've been cooking with MSG. So MSG is monosodium glutamate, right? How many of you have heard of MSG? Yeah. How many of you think that MSG is a really negative health additive that has really bad implications on your health? All right, great. So this is what MSG looks like. It was created in 1903 by a Japanese scientist. He distilled it from seaweed. And what MSG stands for is monosodium. Sodium, of course, is related to salt. And then the glutamate. Now, glutamate is a really fascinating molecule because glutamate is found in things like mushrooms and tomatoes and meats. And what glutamate is umami taste. So we have these different taste receptors. We have one, we have the taste of sweetness, of bitter, of sour. And we also have this umami taste, which is kind of like a depth. It's really hard to describe, but it's all the rage right now. And so in 1903, they were able to distill this substance, MSG. And basically, MSG is to umami what sugar is to sweetness. It is kind of the pure distillation of that taste. And in 1903, when they discovered this, it caught on. It went from Japan to most parts of Asia. It highly influenced Chinese cooking. And in fact, the majority of Chinese households will have MSG on the table to be added to most of the food. And of course, with immigration patterns, we had lots of folks of Asian descent move to the United States. And because of racist immigration laws, one of the only things they could do was open up Chinese restaurants. And so when you open a Chinese restaurant or open a restaurant from your culinary tradition, you're going to bring the things that make your food taste good. I will say that MSG tastes amazing. It tastes like a rich kind of broth, but kind of just like pure, it's delightful. I add it to eggs and stir fries. It's like up to my cooking game in lots of ways. But that's beside the point. So these Chinese restaurants, they brought along MSG. And it was in the 1950s in which there was an article written in a paper in which someone described getting what they called Chinese restaurant syndrome. Have you heard of this? Chinese restaurant syndrome was this experience in the body in which you would sweat, you would get skin flushing, you'd have nausea and headaches. And this article said, it was by this scientist, that it was caused by MSG. He did a bunch of really bad science. He injected mice with a bunch of MSG. And then they had negative reactions. And the story of the ill effects of MSG spread, so much so that I remember going into the food court at the local university when I was growing up, and the Chinese restaurant had MSG, the no MSG sign, right? They had to publicly declare that they didn't use this additive. And not using MSG in Chinese cooking, at least in the 20th and 21st century, is kind of like Applebee's not using salt. I mean, it's just kind of a part of it. And sociologists, as they've looked at why did this trend kick on, why did it become such a viral adoption, they said it primarily had to do with the fact that it was used by a racial other. Then in the white United States, the fact that there was this mysterious foreign additive being added in foreign food created a sort of mass hysteria in which psychosomatic symptoms started to emerge. Because when they did detailed science, double-blind studies on humans, and they subjected them to MSG, they found no. These sorts of stories, though, are a big part of our society. These messages that we get about what types of food are good, what types of food are bad, what food contributes to our health, and what don't. But we're living in a time in which we're experiencing what I kind of describe as whiplash in the experience of what healthy eating looks like. Because every few years, even every few months, we start to hear a new story about what types of food contribute to health and what types of foods don't. On a small scale, I feel like I listen to NPR all the time, and suddenly chocolate is good, and then it's bad, and then it's good again, and then wine is evil, and then it's great, right? But then on a mass level, we have been moving back and forth with various fad diets and eating practices in between, you know, thinking that fats are entirely bad for our diets. That specific story also started in the 1950s, that fats contributed to cardiovascular disease. There, of course, were a few studies that said that was the case. And so an entire generation started to not eat fats, right? Are you this generation that you stopped eating butter? Some of you, yeah? Fat-free foods became a part of our lifestyles. And yet when they do longitudinal studies about whether or not decreasing saturated fats increases heart health, they find no correlation. Fascinating, right? Because that story of fats being bad for our health is so ingrained in us. And yet it is a story that doesn't bear the connection that we think it does. And so we live in this era in which the stories that we're being told about how to be healthy from so-called experts seem to go back and forth all the time. And the challenging nature about living in that experience is that it has led us to enter sort of a post-truth era when it comes to food. Because we've been living in a time in which those who are supposed to understand what is going to make us healthy have been telling us for decades what to do, and yet we're not getting any healthier as a society. And so, in that space, in that kind of post-truth age, when we feel like we can't trust the scientific establishment or trust the mainstream messages about food, we see the rise of these other alternative stories that tell us how to eat and how to be healthy. These are these lifestyle gurus that pop up every few years promising to revolutionize not only the way you eat, your weight, cure you of cancer, and make your skin just glow. All of these things that prescribe a very specific way of eating. The current one that we're kind of in right now is this phase of clean eating. And clean eating says that what we're eating now as a society is not only fattening, but it is impure and unhealthy regardless. And clean eating tells us that we need to avoid wheat, sugar, legumes, and most nightshade vegetables, like tomatoes and other things. And I don't want to specifically say that any of these dietary restrictions, dietary practices, which you may all have, are inherently wrong, in which many of them have seeds of truth, and for you, if they are cultivating nourishment and joy, please do them. But the problem is that these stories start to peddle a lot of times a lot of pseudoscience. And beyond that, in this whiplash of fads around food and stories about food, they contribute to this very dangerous message. And this dangerous message is that there are really good foods and there are really bad foods. And when we live in a society in which we're constantly categorizing foods as good and bad, and even as things change and foods that were once bad are now good, there's like this ghost effect, right? There's this ghost effect of this food that we thought was bad. And even if people are telling us about it being good, it's still there. And so suddenly we live in this kind of haunted society. We enter a shopping mall and there's ghosts everywhere and we're not exactly sure what to eat. And so it leads our society to, for example, 33% of Americans are avoiding eating wheat. Even though when you do double-blind studies of people and you expose them to gluten, which is the fear, most people do not react unless you have celiac disease. But yet this story that wheat is bad for us has become a deep part of our lives. And that's dangerous because what it does is it breaks our relationship with food and it breaks our relationship with our bodies. Only 10% of Americans report that they love cooking. 45% say they hate it. Beyond that, 2017 is the first year in which the average American family will spend more eating out than groceries at home. With the rise of things like food networks and celebrity food bloggers, we thought this would enter into an era in which all of us would be furnished with the skills and the inspiration to be cooking more at home, and yet we've realized that it actually doesn't. In fact, we've charted the food network's rise with a decrease in home chefs' confidence in cooking. And it has become what sociologists are calling gastronomic pornography. It is a fantasy that we indulge in to watch other people create fantastical dishes that look great, that smell great, that promise to taste great, and yet there's such a big gulf between that capacity and where we feel like we are that we don't even attempt to cook. Because our stir fries or our meatloaves or whatever we're trying to cook just doesn't measure up. And what that does is it breaks again our connection with food itself. But there's one really, I think, the most important part of this whole story. And the most important part of this whole story is that as we've been breaking our relationship with food and as we've been breaking our relationship with the body, we've had this underlying moral virtue that is at play here. And it's underlying moral virtue that you may not be able to name as such, but I think when you hear it, you maybe agree. We in our society believe that thinness is a moral virtue. That thinness is a moral virtue. We have a conception in our society that the thinner you are, the more morally virtuous you are because you're more healthy. We have this story that the types of food we eat contribute to our relationship with this moral virtue of thinness. Despite the fact that more and more studies are telling us that our body mass index, our relative size, actually is not as deeply correlated with health as we thought it was. And in fact, those with higher BMIs, higher body mass, who are larger in volume, actually respond better to certain diseases and to traumatic injuries. Interesting. But this moral virtue that we live with, that tells us that there are certain types of bodies, what it does is it taints food we eat because it adds this story that when we eat this food, we are connected to these morally imperfect bodies. And who wants to be associated with a morally imperfect body? Because morally imperfect, there's one, yes. Right? Because these morally imperfect bodies are our bodies, right? When we say that someone has a morally imperfect body, we're saying that one of us has a body that is deficient. And rather than judging that from whether or not they're actually living the life they want to be living, we judge it from basically a standard of size. Our response to this malformed food system that we live in, and we do live in one. We live in a food system in which we are disconnected from the food that is being produced. We're disconnected from the preparation of food. We're disconnected from other people because of our schedules don't actually allow us to connect about food. We live in a system in which industrial agriculture and factory farming are causing deep environmental degradation in our world. We have a malformed food system. We are eating more and more calorically dense food all the time and yet live more sedentary lifestyles. All of these are not good. And yet we can't correct that entire food system by adopting an ideology that has malformed itself. This idea that we're aiming towards creating these good bodies by eating good foods, by restricting and disconnecting from food itself. I'm going to show you this picture up here, Amy, if you'd throw up. So this is writer Glennon Doyle. She posted this on Facebook about and this is the caption that was associated with this post. Day 10 of the Whole 30 eating thing. So the Whole 30 is one of these fads in which there are certain foods that you eliminate and then you add them back to see how your body reacts. If you're doing that, great. And day 10 of the Whole 30 eating thing. I'm too weak and homicidal to explain it well. But it's some kind of food torture plan in which you do not eat any sugar, dairy, bread, or processed foods. If you're wondering what processed foods are, well, it turns out that processed foods are all the foods that are good, period. Like all the foods in the pantry, period. And the only foods you can eat are eggs and vegetables and fruit and meat and like stuff God made. Who wants to eat stuff God made? Nobody, that's who. That's why we invented factories. I can't type any more words. I'll tell you this. My friend Jen Hatmaker is doing the same plan, and when I asked her what she eats for snacks, she says, I eat sadness. We can't reform our malformed food system with a malformed relationship with food in which we are consuming a diet of sadness. Because those messages, those stories about the food, need to be as nutritious as the food we're eating. And when they are filled with shame and restrictions and disconnection, we are not nourishing our bodies. And so that's why in this series of We Believe, in which we're talking about bold proclamations from Unitarian Universalism for our day, I think it is very imperative that we as Unitarian Universalists take a stand against these stories that infiltrate our society. We need to take a stand not only for our own salvation, but for each other's. My Unitarian Universalist faith tells me that our bodies are places of deep wisdom if we listen to them. And that those stories that tell us about what we should want and should be and how our bodies should behave and what they should look like, all of those shoulds actually disorder our ability to connect with our body's rhythms and systems. And when we are most connected to our body's rhythms and systems, when we know what types of food it likes, what types of foods allow it to get the energy, when we feel good about eating rather than feeling ashamed of eating, we disconnect from that wisdom, from our bodies. And as the Unitarian Universalist who says and believes and is convicted that truth comes from all places, truth comes from your body too. And we need to listen. The other reason why I think this is a Unitarian Universalist conception that we need to kind of proclaim this is that in our faith, our bodies aren't temples in the way that they are kind of sacred, separate, that they are a refuge from the impurity of the world. Our bodies aren't temples in that way. In fact, in our faith, our bodies are temples because they are holy and worthy, period. That our bodies are temples because that's where our giftedness flows. That's where we're able to actually impact the world. We're able to choose to love, to take these hands and make a difference. That's why our bodies are temple. That's why they're holy and whole. And so my bold claim is that nothing which offers to sustain that body in that temple can defile it. That nothing that sustains our bodies can defile it. Only the stories that we tell about what that is. And so my radical pronouncement, which maybe is radical or is not, is that we as a society and as a faith, we actually need to starve ourselves from these messages about food. That we need to radically stop in its place this disordered thinking about food itself. And we need to figure out a way to detach these messages that we're hearing from the food we're eating. And it's really fascinating because back in the 18th and 19th century, our Universalist forebears, well, they had this really interesting conundrum. They had this conundrum because they were going around preaching universal salvation. They were saying that you, no matter what you've done in your life, are going to heaven. And their detractors would come up to them and they'd say, okay, well, even if that's true, why would you tell people that? Because when you tell someone they're going to heaven, they're not going to act very well. And the universalist response was always that when someone knows that they're going to heaven, when they know they're loved by God, they're going to act for morality's sake itself. That you don't need some external reward or punishment to act well. You need the freedom and the motivation to do so. And that's why, as a society, what we need to do, and my conviction as Unitarian Universalist, what we need to do is actually completely stop these messages about food altogether in their place. Because your body, no matter what it eats, is worthy. No matter what it looks like, is worthy. No matter how you feel about it, is worthy. And instead of thinking that foods are going to defile it, or foods are going to bring you further away from a norm, when you give yourself freedom to feel that liberation, that connection, that gratitude for this body, which is whole and pure, from that place, you're going to make the best choices about what your body needs. From that place, you're going to pick the foods and the lifestyle that are going to nourish your body the best, instead of feeding into this ideology, which is constantly policing what you're eating. So here's my suggestion. I suggest for a month at least, we stop reading the nutritional contents of all things. That we stop any diets we're doing, that we stop any food restrictions, that we notice when the food police have taken up the precincts on our plates, right? And are telling us and inducing shame about what we're eating. We stop them in their tracks and we say, you've had enough time. It's now time for me. It's now time for me to figure out how I can connect with my body. Because that connection and that story, to actually listen to our bodies, to feel connected and not ashamed, is going to allow you to understand when you're full, when you need food, and how your body needs to move, not some societal story that tells you it's good or not. And so I offer you this video, which is kind of my blessing and benediction for us all.
Your body is welcome here. All of it. Yes, even that part and that part. And yes, even that part too. The parts you love and the parts you don't. From this place, we come with all that we are, all that we have been, and all that we are going to be. Our bodies are constantly changing. Cells die and cells are reborn. We respond to infection and disease, sometimes divorcing them from our bodies. Other times they become just another part of us. Your body and all that is within it, both wanted and unwanted, has a place here. For our bodies join in a web of co-creation, created and creating, constantly changing and constantly changing us. They are scarred and tattooed, tense and relaxed, diseased and cured, unfamiliar and deeply intimate. Formed in an infinite diversity of creation, your body is welcome here, all of it. All of it. So take a moment to feel. Take a moment to be. Take a moment to rest in your body's care. Your body is welcome here.